Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion and the Center for Humanities titled Non-Self as Omnipresent Interpersonalities, Tiantai's Four Steps for Rereading Impermanence as the Eternity of All Subjective States. Our speaker is Brooke Ziporin, University of Chicago Divinity School Professor of Chinese Religion, Philosophy, and Comparative Thought. We'll begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel.
Professor Brooke Ziporin received his BA in East Asian Languages and Civilizations from Chicago and PhD from Michigan before joining the Divinity School faculty at the University of Chicago, where he presently teaches. He taught Chinese philosophy and religion at Michigan, Northwestern, Harvard, and the National University of Singapore, which has a very interesting international place in the study of issues like this. He's the author of several fine books on Chinese philosophy, including a book on Zhuangzi and the concept of Li, and multiple books on Tiantai philosophy, like this beautiful book on emptiness and omnipresence in Tiantai. The Tiantai tradition is a distinctively Chinese tradition of philosophy that was immensely influential in the development of East Asian tradition. It's the source of Tendai Buddhism in Japan, and Tendai is the source of Nichiren Buddhism, Pure Land Buddhism, and Zen. So this is a central tradition in the study of East Asian Buddhism. We're very lucky to have him speaking to us here today, and I hope you'll join me in welcoming Professor Brooke Ziporin to Boston University.
Thank you very much. As David just mentioned, you probably know Buddhism, widely known for its teaching of non-self, denying the ultimate reality of Atman, an unchanging, independent core of selfhood beyond the impermanence and conditionality that pertain to all experienced reality. And the question, sort of the first way to start us, I think, into this issue is to ask what does non-self imply about persons? We know it's not actually a denial of the importance of human persons in sort of standard kind of universally within Buddhism. There is a kind of special status of the human being in most Buddhist thought. Since Buddhas, the achievement of enlightenment, the achievement of Buddhahood depends on being a human being. It's looked at as sort of a rare opportunity to be reborn as a human. That gets tweaked and played with a little bit later in the Mahayana and in other later parts of the tradition. But basically, there is that. That's perfectly compatible with the non-self idea. That's clear. It's sort of between gods and animals to be a human person, right? Just enough suffering, but not to care about suffering, to be pressed into the interest in solving the problem of suffering. Unlike the gods, who are having too good a time to care about liberating themselves. And unlike the animals who are too sunken in ignorance to really get up above it. So that's the kind of way the human person is situated there. But there does seem to be, I think, a commonsensical way to read the tradition in something like what we have in the present-day Theravada tradition would be to equate self and person and then take it that the denial of self is a denial at least of the ultimate reality of the person, of the personality. Of the experienced self as controller and center of action and experience. What appears to be personal experience, experience that pertains to a person on this reading, would be, if viewed correctly, really impersonal natural causal phenomena. That's one way to understand Theravada traditions. And you can see why personhood and selfhood are sort of intuitively closely related, right? Some of the things a very elusive concept. In fact, I'm going to refer a little later to a remark of Spinoza's, right? Somebody asked him if his conception of deity was personal, and he said, I can't really attach any clear and distinct notion to this word person. Right? There's no way for me to answer. It's kind of a meaningless question, which of course is a way of saying it doesn't really fit into my final vocabulary at all, and that really does amount to something like this denial of the ultimate reality of personhood. It's an OTO's category on that reading. But there are some ways in which personhood and selfhood are very closely related. This slide is a way of trying to get at, for me, some intuitive senses of person, of personality, of personhood, as they're related to the notion of self in this specifically Buddhist sense, this sense of independent, unconditional, permanent, beyond the reach of ordinary causality. In Buddhism, that means multiple causality, which is to say many causes leading to many effects. So a person is usually conceived as some kind of having some kind of persistence and agency, some single doer of a deed, which has to be identical with a proposed experiencer of the results of that deed. So that means continuity or sameness across time, at least continuity between them, privileged as a primary lens of understanding action, if not ultimate absolute sameness, at least continuity as privileged. And that notion, I think, plays into ways we think about purpose, final causality, the past-future narrative in terms of purpose of action, the conceived end persisting unchanged from beginning to end, that you know what I mean by final causality, that is action with a purpose. When those things in the world that do things not because they're caused, but because they have reasons, i.e. that they have purposes in mind, we call persons. That's one way to sort of narrow down that notion. A little Kantian twist on this would be a person as purposive being in several senses, conceiving and acting due to purposes, and also being a purpose, that is, being an end of him, an end in himself, having the dignity of a person in that sense. And a third related notion, self-relation, combining those previous two, to regard oneself as an end, and self-consciousness conceived in that way, self-understanding of the self. I would link this also to the idea of legal responsibility, the notion of person as a legal concept, that is to say, and this pertains to the use of the notion of free will, responsibility as accountability in locating a single first cause of deeds, right? On a broadly Buddhist picture, as I'll get to when we talk about multiple causality, becomes a problem on how you limit what actually caused any event. Why did so-and-so die? Well, this happened, but why did this happen, right? You get an infinite regress of causes. Free will and the notion of person or a free person is introduced as a legal term in order to parse that, give it a starting point, and therefore give accountability in a legal sense. So the question is, when the Buddhists deny self, are they denying all that stuff about the person? And in a broad way, I'd like to say, you know, we can think of soteriology as going down two different kinds of possible roads. One involves the exaltation of personality, and one involves the loss of personality. I would say the Platonic monotheist approaches tend to see a religious meaning in absolutizing all that stuff I just mentioned about personhood, namely purposivity, ends in themselves, accountability, single cause, agency, and so on. Whether that means one renounces one's own purposes in light of a greater purpose or a greater person, a deity, or one is supported in one's purposes by those greater purposes. I'll skip the secularism one. And then this Buddhist, what I'm calling this Theravada, maybe this also related to Taoism, some readings of Zen, Spinoza, a soteriological meaning to the loss of personhood. And I don't think we should neglect that, although that we're going to go in a slightly different direction here. The release from my own purpose is not in honoring a greater purpose, but as a critique of the very notion of purpose, of personality itself. Liberation as the loss of meaning and purpose as previously conceived. So that's one way to read this early Buddhist notion of non-self. You could understand non-self as exaltation. You could understand as some readings of this somewhat now no longer extant but really interesting early Buddhist school, the Pugdalavadins, this notion of the person as an irreducible category that eludes all causal and myriological analysis. Non-self, on this reading, would be kind of a caution about thinking of the person as a thing, as a substance, really as any kind of conceivable entity. And I'll skip that in the interest of time. I only set that up because I want to say that the school we'll be talking about today, the Chinese Tiantai school, takes an approach that I take to be different from both of these. Not the soteriological meaning of non-self as I'm attributing loosely, people can object to this maybe to Theravadin reading of the non-self doctrine, nor the Pugdalavadin, and maybe similar to the Platonic theistic notions of selfhood as something transcendent to normal causal analysis, but actually a convergence of these ideas, which is going to see the denial of self and the affirmation of self as two sides of the same claim. How is that possible, right? That's what this lecture is about. So in accepting both of these seemingly divergent views, modifying what that conception of selfhood is. And by the end of this lecture, hopefully we'll get there. Now to get at this, I have four steps I mentioned in the title of this talk. Tantai Buddhism developed a system of four teachings, which provides a rubric for rereading the key teachings of early Buddhism. And these teachings are things I hope some of you are by now familiar with, things like impermanence, suffering, non-self of all phenomena, in which it regards as increasingly comprehensive and profound teachings, not replacing or refuting those initial teachings, but progressively recontextualizing them such that it is understood to imply further, sometimes apparently contradictory meanings. So when I talk about the affirmation of self, the Tantai Buddhists don't think they're refuting the notion of non-self. They think they're recontextualizing it to bring out a further meaning of it when they talk about self in this new sense. So the basic teaching of non-self, which is initially understood as a denial of the ultimate reality of all personhood and real agency, including divinities for any sentient being, ends up reread as also denoting not being replaced by the assertion of the omnipresence and eternity, not only of all personhood and agency, but even of every state of every sentient being. There's a historical background to this. There's this thing called panjiao, classification of teachings, the Chinese Buddhists were faced with this problem. They had a massive number of texts being translated into Chinese, and they had to organize them. They tended to do that hierarchically to say which are ultimate teachings, they had these categories in earlier Buddhism, and which are provisional teachings, right? Although they were all true in some sense. This was one of the motors behind developing notions of partial truths, or truths that are gradually revealed, and which, although on the face of it, these teachings are very contradictory, seeking a way in which ultimately they harmonized or even announced the same thing. And this very idea, they derived, actually, from an expansion of the non-self idea. That is, you could say, the notion that things, not only persons, not only phenomena, but meanings of teachings do not have a fixed self nature, that they are contextual or relational through and through, which is to say the meaning of a word, the meaning of a teaching, the meaning of an idea changes depending on what you relate it to. So in the sense of middle way, the result must be that impermanence is no longer something other than permanence, self not other than non-self, suffering not other than bliss. The target is a concept of self that is equally non-self, of bliss that is also suffering, of permanence that is also impermanence. Why? Because Buddhists from the beginning have this idea that the only way to solve the problem of suffering is to find something unconditional. Anything conditional will be impermanent, will be unstable, will be permeated by suffering. And so they posit this idea of nirvana, nibbana, as the one unconditional state, where all suffering ends. Anything conditional would be less than that. But anything that has an opposite, anything that could either be or not be, anything that is self as opposed to non-self, that is finite, is ipso facto conditional, which is why in early Buddhism, when they want to talk about nirvana, they will simply go full-on apophatic. They will say there's nothing specific we can say about it. Anything unconditional would be beyond any determinate predication. So the end of suffering has to be beyond predication. If we take non-self as a predication, that is to say, if it excludes anything like self, or impermanence to deny anything like impermanent, like permanence, then it can't really be nirvana. So nirvana is going to have to be equally identifiable in any of those ways. So we're looking for something unconditional, and the unconditional cannot just be non-self. Of course, non-self is a privileged way of starting that conversation, of bringing up this problem of the conditional, but it can't be, if it's understood as the exclusion of self, or if impermanence is understood as the exclusion of permanence, or if permanence is understood as the exclusion of impermanence, none of those can fit the required bill according to the Buddhist diagnosis. There are four teachings in the way the Tiantai organize Buddhist teaching as a whole, of progressively deeper exploration of the same basic idea. The same basic idea is what? Non-self, impermanence, suffering. If you want to put it another way, conditionality, dependent co-arising, multiple causality, the impossibility of a single agent or a single nature causing a single effect. That's it. All Buddhism. but we reread that, the implications of that, okay, in these four ways. First, what they call the Zhangjiao, that's the pre-Mahayana scriptural teaching. That teaches something you will still read in Buddhist textbook. All phenomena arise and perish. In fact, this happens very quickly and momentarily, every moment, thousands and millions of times perhaps, dissolving, and anything that looks like a unity or a whole dissolves in real time into its component parts. Everything is impermanent in that self, sorry. Persons are one of these unities. They are an illusion. They are a misperception. They seem to be a single cause, for example, in my agency, or a single identity, but looked at more closely, you can see, A, that they're composed of multiple, diverse, divergent parts, and if you wait long enough, they will dissolve into those parts and disappear. They are not ultimate realities. There are no persons. That's the first teaching in Buddhism. The next step in Tiantai, they will say, the shared teaching. Here's the basic outline. I'll go over these in detail in a moment. Not only emptiness of persons, where phenomena are real but persons are unreal, but now emptiness also of those phenomena of which persons are composed. And this is a big step. You may be familiar with this from Mahayana philosophy, right? Emptiness of all things, which means phenomena, impersonal phenomena, are not more real than persons. They're both equally unreal, both equally real. The contrast between those levels has disappeared. But for any determinate thing at all, the fact that it is conditional or relational means that it is empty of a single unambiguous identity that could persist in every possible context, every possible spatio-temporal context or semantic context. And this is just the quick overview, okay? Third, separate teaching for bodhisattvas. Now, I'll tell you what a bodhisattva is in detail later, but basically these are people who voluntarily stay within rebirth, make a vow, a personal, intentional vow to liberate all sentient beings before they themselves will accept their own liberation. And in Tiantai, they give a separate teaching to them, which they call the Biejiao, the separate teaching, where now infinite is looked at as infinite, as enabling infinite production of determinations. It's no longer just a denial. It can't be X, it can't be Y, pure apophaticism. The bodhisattvas, as we'll discuss, will now make up stuff because sentient beings suffer by making up stuff, and they make up counteractive stuff. And the reason they're able to do that is, again, because of the non-fixity, impermanence, emptiness that has been discovered in the previous teaching. And finally, in Tiantai, the perfect all-around integrated circular teaching, Yuanjiao. Very quickly, emptiness is infinite. Willed makings from number three are never made, are themselves omnipresent, are eternal, and the interfusion of the identity of that center, emptiness, and production. But, and this is what I was briefly alluding to a moment ago, this introduces a paradox, and this is kind of the engine of our walk through these four stages, okay? I'll call it the Nirvana paradox. As I said a moment ago, only something unconditional can be free of suffering. Whatever is impermanent is conditional, that is, multi-caused, non-self, not brought about by any single entity, any single item, any single cause. Therefore, multi-affected, having multiple effects, unstable, satisfactory to no single agenda, therefore suffering, okay? But anything determinate is ipso facto conditional. So in this stage of Buddhism, familiar to many of you, the paradox is that the unconditional cannot begin at any particular place and time. If it did, that place and time or that set of practices would ipso facto be a condition, okay? And it would thereby not be conditional. And yet, Nirvana is always spoken of in early Buddhism as something that you do certain things, do certain practices, and quote-unquote attain. Now, they're well aware of this problem, and they deal with it, as I say here, with apophaticism. They just say, look, there's nothing we can really say about it. Some of you may know the parable of the raft or the parable of the arrow as ways of addressing this problem. It's kind of, we can talk about that in Q&A if you'd like. But I bring that up because this is a useful way to look at what happens in the next stage, step two, the shared teaching, i.e., addressing this and giving a solution to it. And that solution is basically that indeed nirvana must always exist in all times and places. We'll also talk about this as the already empty nature of all phenomena. They cannot be any further extinguished. Sometimes Buddha nature talk is understood in this way as well. Okay, they call this ti kong, the essential body of any entity as emptiness. Nothing is born wu sheng si di. That means, in reality, if understood correctly, nothing arises and perishes. Okay, everything's already nirvana. There are no definite entities to arise at a specific time and place because nirvana is already happening everywhere, by definition. However, this introduces, and so that's a way of solving the nirvana paradox, but it introduces a new problem. The new problem is now we have a kind of epistemological split. Sometimes this is discussed in Buddhism in terms of the two truths. In reality, everything is already empty, all things are nirvanic, you are already enlightened. But in conventional, and I have never arisen, I will never perish, there is no such person, nor are there any of my component parts, there is no temporal process. But nonetheless, I experience that way, I describe things that way, I make distinctions and so on, and those are now on me, my deluded attachments. Some of those can be what they call conventional truths, which I can then use as a kind of wedge to reach the ultimate truth. So we have two truths, conventional truth, ultimate truth. Ultimate truth, you could say emptiness, but emptiness too, as a word, as a concept, as something determinate, is going to be really a conventional truth. So we'll talk about the emptiness of emptiness. And what is ultimate truth? It really has no propositional content at all. There is nothing really that can be said. There are no views that are adequate to it. So we have this actually very huge split now epistemologically between the two truths. We have possible determinations, all of which are conventional, some wholesome, some unwholesome. And then we have ultimate truth, which says nothing is ever born. There is no extinction into nirvana. Everything is extinguished already. That's our new problem. Solution and a new problem. The appearance-reality split now becomes exacerbated. Okay. So pushes this problem to the next level. And I'd like to pursue that by saying, is that too quick? So the solution to that problem now, we start with, now let me talk a little bit more about the bodhisattvas. So there we have a position where, yes, there are conventional truths, there's ultimate truth. How do we bridge them? Well, the Mahayana Buddhism introduces this idea of these figures, as I mentioned, called bodhisattvas, who voluntarily postpone their own liberation, their own enlightenment, in order to remain, to liberate all beings by remaining in samsara for immeasurably vast eons, to be born again and again in body after body, so as to interact with innumerable sentient beings, producing innumerable, precisely tailored and maximally effective teachings and bodily forms in response to the individual vicissitudes of each of those encounters and each of those challenges. These bodhisattvas have understood that all things are empty, but they see this not merely as not merely the negation and therefore the transcendence of all determinate characteristics, all forms, but also a negation of the negation and the transcendence of this transcendence, insofar as the first negation is itself something determinate. In other words, emptiness, if we take that as something determinate, will now itself be conditional. And if it excludes anything, it is ipso facto determinate. So if it excludes the arising of phenomena, then it is not truly empty. This is what I mean by taking the same idea and just going deeper into it, but seeming to have a completely opposite conclusion, right? It's really the same idea, but now following through, thinking it through all the way. They also see that transcending and negating any specific form, liberation from any form, attachment to any form, is done via the creation of a counterbalancing or neutralizing form. Two is neutralized by negative two, let's say, not by zero. So we don't just go to zero, 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 denial, denial, denial. Sometimes the counteracting of a specific form involves the creation of an alternate form. This is supposed to be tailored to each sentient being very specifically in this very thick sort of interpersonal relationship. This means the liberation from all determinate forms is done not through universal blankness or universal destruction, but by limitless creativity of forms, by the production in each case of the precisely countervailing form. Okay, so requires infinite creativity, produces infinite forms. Now, in Tiantai, this is part of general Mahayana belief that there are these figures, and there's a lot about them in sutras, but Tiantai gives it a special meaning that what these bodhisattvas see is that our previous understanding of emptiness is not really sufficient, that we really now start to have to talk about the middle way. Why? Because they want to say, actually, these bodhisattvas see that it's really not the case that emptiness is more ultimate than this creation of forms. Rather, emptiness on the one hand, what we've been calling ultimate truth, and the creation of conventional forms, and actually an infinity of them, and as Tiantai will put it, the Uliang Sidi, are two sides of the same coin. And what they really are, what's really true about them, is something they call the middle. The center, the middle way. Zhong, this is a very distinctive Tiantai addition. So they want to say the middle is something that can appear either as the production of forms or the negation of forms, either as the invention of new ways of describing things or the undermining of those ways. But neither one of those is ultimate, and we have to posit a third thing that is more ultimate than both of those alternatives. And from the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, they get this idea of the Buddha nature, which is identified there as the middle way. This is where we're going to start. That's the Indian scriptural basis for saying Buddha nature is self, non-self, permanent, impermanent, bliss, suffering, pure, impure, okay? Middle way of those four features that had been the key ideas in Buddhism. And to invent, on the one hand, the negation of every possible form, but also the opening up of what they call Uliang Sidi, the infinite versions of suffering, the infinite versions, redescriptions of causes of suffering, infinite redescriptions of what the end of suffering is, and infinite redescriptions of ways to go beyond that. So this is the contribution of the separate teaching, the middle way Buddha nature, where emptiness and the establishment of provisional forms are both non-ultimate, both pointing to something that can express itself in either of these two ways. You can say self or selves, let's say, and you can say non-self for both of those. Coin metaphor. This means actually a further thinking through of emptiness, where it's understood that emptiness is not just a denial and it's not just an affirmation. It's what we might call ontological ambiguity, something that makes no claim about the existence or the non-existence, the presence or the absence of something, but is systematically resistant to being determined in any one way. Ontological ambiguity, not just epistemological ambiguity where I'm not sure what it is, but it isn't any one thing, even emptiness. That wouldn't be empty enough, right, to be definitely empty. So in this middle, it's actually a rewriting of the notion of emptiness. Coin metaphor. I said there were two sides of the same coin. You can think of it this way, right? You might say previously, if you think of like the famous Buddhist, sometimes they use this metaphor of water and waves, right? And first level of understanding water waves, you can say, okay, there's all these determinate phenomena, but they're all made of water, or the wetness of the water is the same in all cases. It's not fixed to any one form. And you might say, first approach to say, okay, so the waves are kind of epiphenomena, but what's real is the water, okay, which is beyond any the form, the shape, the velocity, whatever, any characteristics of any of those waves. You might go a different way, go further and say, well, they're co-present, right? So everywhere there's wave, there's wetness, and maybe you can go on to assert wherever there's wetness, there's also wave. You understand wetness meaning emptiness, the negation of forms, wave meaning specific determinate forms. Think about this now as a coin. And the coin is useful because we can think of the bottom edge of this ocean. So think of a coin that has stuff imprinted on it, like figures of everyone in this room, and on the other side is blank. In those earlier, when I think about ocean and wave, I might be thinking, okay, all those forms of us are really this blankness, this something beyond any one particular form that can be shaped into any form, right? Like the metal of the coin. And so that's more ultimate than the forms. If I have a two-sided coin and one side is blank, I can say, oh, actually, one side is blank, one side is non-blank, but they're both just sides. And both of them are an expression of this thing in the middle, between them, which is just as much formed as unformed. It's not that it's more like the unformed than the form. Both of, we never are seeing directly that middle. We're always seeing it either in the form of the negation or in the form of the affirmation. Hence, the middle, okay, expressing itself in these two ways. But not static, I say here, because, of course, you'd have to think of the engraving on this as this wild mass of causal, impermanent creation of effects these bodhisattvas are inventing in response to fictions created by deluded sentient beings. Notice here that personhood and will and purpose and all that stuff that got negated at step one come back here in a new way with a vengeance. At least certain persons, these bodhisattvas, suddenly become very important. Deluded beings have desires and delusions where they see themselves as persons. They see certain unities and certain continuities as permanences and substances. And bodhisattvas respond to that because they have made a vow. A vow is really just a euphemism for a real big desire. Okay, the desires that were kicked out in the earlier part of Buddhism, now purposive action and personal decisions come back in, right? Certain interventions are made, and they're done for a reason. The reason is the vow. The vow is to liberate sentient beings. This is a really interesting concept in the Mahayana because compassion as self-interest also is built on the realization of non-self. I always like to use this. This is a Seinfeld example, right? The night guy, morning guy example, right? Question is always, why does night guy, why if you're drinking one night, why do you care about what happens to morning guy with the hangover if you're a Buddhist? Well, if you're a Buddhist, you know that morning guy is not the same person, the self-same person as you. And yet, de facto, whenever we're self-interested, we're somehow reaching across these non-self continuities, right? We care about someone non-self already, however selfish you may be, some degree of bridging that non-self gap. Well, the bodhisattva simply universalize this, where they start to care about all the non-selves equally in that way, the same way that night guy cares about morning guy. And so we have here a nice little example of non-self, self-interest universalized and thereby coming to mean infinite personal and interpersonal compassion on the premise of non-self. Now, in each of these steps, we'd had a solution to a prior problem and then a new problem arise. And we have that again here. The separateness of the agent and the act and the experience of aspects, sides. This is in the separate teaching. Separateness, in Tiantai works, we'll like to stress the word, almost like a pun here, bie, pertains here on all levers under this form of creativity or production. It still implies a real difference between, first of all, the phases of not yet produced. So there's an act of will, there's a decision, there's a deed done, and something has changed, some real thing has altered in an important or prioritized way between it not yet having been done. All the stuff that went with personality that was a problem in early Buddhism kind of comes back here, right? Certain people do certain things, they have certain deeds, they have certain merits that accrue to them. It's either done or not done, right? There's a separation between the empty aspect and the non-empty aspect of the center. So if I'm looking at a coin, I can only see one at a time, right? And I don't say just to see the blank side is to see the carved side. I just say they both reduce to some third thing that can express itself either way. But the aspects are still separable, even if ontologically they're inseparable. And so we get something like that appearance-reality division that we had back in the shared teaching. More importantly, this means also that these bodhisattvas understand the phases of bodhisattva practice as really separate from one another, phases of time as genuinely distinct, and we have our unconditionality problem again. Also, the Shravaka, or the Hinayana, so-called practitioner, is separate from the bodhisattva, and the bodhisattva from a Buddha. Above all, the deluded sentient being to be liberated is separate from the liberating bodhisattva, insofar as the deluded being has his own fictions, that is, his attachments, his delusions. He thinks he's a self. He thinks this is a lectern. He thinks this is a room, right? And he's very committed to those ideas. And the bodhisattva comes up with his own fictions to counteract those, to undo them, to loosen them. But those two acts are still completely separate acts. Now, the idea of two separate things relating to each other, that is, pre-existing their relation and simply existing as what they are, is something that we've already been undermined since the shared teaching, since the emptiness teaching, where even the idea of causality, the move from a cause to an effect of two really distinct and fully constituted ontological entities is shown to be incoherent. That's why in Ultimate Truth, we cannot say that anything has really arisen. And the same thing applies here. That relation of two separate beings is also seen to be incoherent. Some are creating liberatively from emptiness and some are not. So that separateness that pertains to agency, the primary Buddhist problem, sort of comes back here. So I'll put this another way to push this. This again reproduces the gulf between the absolute and the relative, the unconditioned and the conditioned. More fundamentally, although both all things are empty and all things are non-empty, are valid, so that I can say this is a cup or this is not a cup. And even in a certain way, I can say this is a cup or this is a frog, let's say if I'm a bodhisattva who wants to use that to undermine something. Really, neither of those is quite as true as saying, like I'm saying now, both of those are true. One of them in isolation is not quite as true as knowing the global picture that is the center that connects these seemingly opposite things. Okay, that's the last level of separateness to be worked on. And then we get to the perfect teaching. And here's the watchwords of that. It's called the Uzo Sidi, the unmade Four Noble Truths. Each of these stages, I'll go back to that in a second, presupposes the previous. So we had emptiness of selves, but reality of persons. That was one, right? Emptiness of both selves and persons. The emptiness that is also generative, so that it's really the middle way, through the intervention of the specific purposive acts of the bodhisattvas. And now that infinite productivity of meanings, of deeds, of willed effects, of subjective states and counterstates, not as the deeds of some particular being in a particular time and place, a bodhisattva, but that bodhisattvahood itself as something unmade, something that pervades all times and places, that is nirvanic in just the way we've been, again, expanding the meaning of since the shared teaching, something that can't be in just one time and place, which is always as much prior to findable, prior to the apparent deed, the conventionally designated deed, as it is after the conventionally designated deed, which is to say, it's not absolutely findable in either of those loci, but once it is introduced, it can be found in any of them. Do you understand what I mean? In other words, when we say that something is in one place, we say, here as opposed to there, there's some characteristic that I've identified. I'm going to go off script for this one, I think. Okay? And where there's a real ontological difference between it being here and it not being here, and all the places where it is not. And that is what things are when they're conditional, hence suffering. That means anything a bodhisattva does that falls into that category is still just going to be one more form of suffering, something you strive toward, something that you will have or not have to various degrees, something that can be lost and gained, okay? None of that is going to really solve this problem. So what does the Buddhist analysis, as now we see it in this expanded context, mean? It means that even where I'm doing a deed, as we know, even where there is a lectern, there's not really a lectern. There's an opportunity for finding a lectern if I conventionally posit it, either through my delusion or through my bodhisattva compassion, right? But that means also that there's no greater or lesser presence of the lectern everywhere else. It's not definitively present here. It's not definitively absent here. What it is, then, and I guess I'm going to skip ahead to what I think is really the most interesting and illuminated. You can look at this and maybe look at the actual logical steps for this part, which is the most intricate thing, and I think it'll take maybe too long. But what I really want to get to is this notion. style. This word style. Because I want to introduce to you a way of thinking, just like the coin metaphor is sort of helpful for shared teaching. I'm just going to give you this metaphor for what I'm trying to talk about, which is the idea not that the essence of things is nirvanic, is unconditional, okay? But that every characteristic, every deed, every sensation, every moment of experience, as they'll say in Tiantai, is omnipresent and eternal. How is it omnipresent and eternal at the same time as empty? And when I say that, I'd like you to think about the phenomenon of style. So when we talk about a style of being, this is not something that is concretely present in a particular place and does not is not restricted to a particular set of contents. It is a rule or a pattern or a way of seeing that can be extended indefinitely or can be subtracted from whatever its primary instance of. So consider a famous painting like, you know, Van Gogh's Starry Night, okay? So that has a very specific style that you could identify as the presence in that place of Van Gogh's style. That's a thing, that's an entity, that's a characteristic. Now, it's also paint smeared on a piece of paper, right? It's also blues and yellows and of certain textures. I don't have to see that as Van Gogh's style. It requires a very certain historical, cultural context, neurological fine-tuning. You know, a cat seeing it or a dog seeing may not be seeing that. An ant crawling on it may not be seeing it. That exact set of entities, that thing is something that if you do perceive it, you can now leave that painting and look elsewhere. And I think you'll know what I mean, and say that you can now start seeing everything in the world Van Gogh-ishly, put it into an adverbial form. Or, in other words, you can imagine what this room would look like if painted in the style of Starry Night, and you could subtract Starry Night from that now, right? Once you have grasped what that style is. It's not mandatory in the painting, but it's equally available once it has been experienced anywhere else. And any content can go into that. Now, you take the next step of that is to say that, what is a content? Like when I say paint, or when I say a star or a tree in the painting, each of those is a style, okay? Is itself a style. When I say I'm looking at everything as a tree or tree-ishly, I would be applying whatever it is I've identified and experienced as that tree and applying it to whatever other contents. This is this intersubsumption idea. Or to give you another example, if you see a filmmaker who has a very distinctive style, I always like to talk about like the Coen Brothers movies in this context, right? Or maybe Tarantino or something, right? If you sit through a long movie like that and you're absorbed in it, you walk out into the street, it's almost like everything you see is in the style of that movie. That pacing, that rhythm, it may be a very hard to pin down thing, but now any content at all can be experienced in that style. What we have here is the bodhisattva's actions as a style, where every action, although it begins at a particular moment in time, every positing of a particular set of characteristics, determinate beings, beings as opposed to non-beings, or things being this way as opposed to that way, they're not facts, they're styles, which means they are provisionally locatable in a particular time and place, but they're also subtractable from that place, and then infinitely universalizable. And when that universalization is done, the elements within that style are now experienced in this double way, so that now let me think about Van Gogh's painting in a Coen Brothers movie, for example. Okay? How is that going to look? And now let me think about the Coen Brothers movie as painted in a Van Gogh painting. This is the intersubsumption of all phenomena. Now think of a deluded sentient being's painting of the world, style of being, style of positing ways of determining what is, and a bodhisattva's ways. This is what we're talking about. Van Gogh's painting of the Coen Brothers movie and the Coen Brothers filming of the Van Gogh painting, okay? And that means that both of them, when they are perceived through the perfect teaching, are seen to be omnipresent, hence meeting the definition we needed for the unconditional, for nirvana, for liberative. But now, as we'll note, only as present in its otherness, as something which is not itself. We don't have a firm, definite thing which excludes other things when we talk about styles. We have something that can accommodate any and every content, right? And so this is where we get this convergence of self and non-self, of permanent and impermanent, of unity and diversity. And I was going to end, and I think I have this, yes, applying this to personhood. Another way to talk about personhood, I had a slide early on where I talked about responsibility, right, and I talked about free will. Now what emerges from this Tantai discussion is another way of understanding what a personality is. A style of being that pervades everything it contacts, revealing itself in all otherness with every juxtaposition, seeing the world in one's own way, having a point of view, which has a built-in continuity toward the future and the past. That is to say, a personality as a viewpoint on the world where all the contents of consciousness are something other than that self. Just like all the contents in the Van Gogh painting are not Van Gogh's style. They are things seen as or through or in the form of or with the character of that style. So it's all non-self, it's all non-Van Gogh, but it's all Van Gogh, right? The convergence of the unity and the diversity. Similarly, with permanence, you should be able to mutatis mutandis through these other terms, permanent and impermanent. There is no one thing that's permanent through all those cases. You cannot pinpoint one thing that's mandatory in there, one sort of determinate factor in that style. Similarly, unity and diversity and so on. And the upshot of that, it's rather small on this slide, but that way of unifying experience, not just as such, in sort of the Kantian way of the transcendental unity of apperception or something, but in the specific way of a person and a personality, a style of being, even a deluded style of being, like the Van Gogh style or the Coen Brothers style, it's also what it means to be something to or for which a world appears. And that would be the claim here as the upshot of this in the Tiantai view. That is, when we talk about consciousness or the co-presence of me and world in my experience, this is what we're talking about, something structured in the way laid out in that doubleness of mutually subsuming styles. And I'll get to the end here, as promised. But Buddhahood realizes not just the selfhood of oneself, that is, my style pervading every part of my experience, but the selfhood, that is, the all-pervadingness of self and otherness of all quiddities, all specific styles, all specific things, and importantly, sentient or insentient. So now we're talking about Buddhahood not as the recognition only of persons as persons in this new sense, but the recognition, of course, also as the lectern as a person in this sense, that is, a unity, a style of being that is infinitely applicable, projectable, subsumable, and subsuming to any and every content, and yet has no mandatory self-same presence, okay? Any quiddity, any determinate thing as such now has that status. This is exactly what we do get in Tiantai dogmatics, the idea of the Buddhahood or the Buddha nature of insentient beings. And I want to push that even further here. It's not just a being, because what does that mean in Buddhism? It's any moment of experience. In Tiantai, they will say, Inyan Sanchen, the 3,000 worlds as each moment of experience. That means it's not just me, the whole person, Brooke, who pervades in this way, or the lectern as this specific thing. It's also that sound of the lectern, or my slight, very specific anxiety about wrapping this sentence up at this moment, that is a style of being that pervades and is findable everywhere, but needn't be found anywhere, right? Personhood, then, as the recognition, self, in the Buddha nature definition, this is the bottom here, as the recognition of the personhood in this sense, not the legal responsibility or the theatrical or the first cause sense, but in this sense that is not incompatible with non-self, which is just a further expanded meaning of non-self, an unpacking of non-self. personhood in all things, person and non-person alike, and therefore recognition of the non-personhood in all things too. Because, and that's the final twist here, right? So they will say anything that you call a person is equally a non-person, including us, right? That stays. That stays from the first stage in Buddhism. We don't say it's a person as opposed to a non-person, right? Obviously, every step we've gone toward the unconditional here would make a problem of that. So, recap. I think we don't need to. We can just say each personality, what a personality is on this view, even what the peculiar style of any moment, any part of a personality of personal experience is now found at the root of all phenomena, discoverable in all phenomena, the telos of all phenomena. This is the self-telos of that sort of Kantian twist. Yes, right? Just as you could say what is expressed, that which is expressed in the various forms of the Van Gogh painting, that style. The stuff from which they're made, yes, you can say that. Yet, not irreducible or non-negotiably present anywhere, even right here, present only as its own otherness. Self is only any universal self when it is also non-self. And the recognition of both self, both person and non-person, in every possible thing and every part of a thing, whether personal or impersonal. Tintai has a way of talking about this. Fa jie doi fa jie qi fa jie. That means the Dharma realm, Dharma Dhatu, the universe, meets the universe such that what arises from their encounter, their face-to-face, is also the whole universe. That sums that up, I think, very well. And that also allows me to finish with a greeting. Hello, and I'm done. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Brooke Zipporin, University of Chicago Divinity School Professor of Chinese Religion, Philosophy, and Comparative Thought. Professor Zipporin's lecture was titled Non-Self as Omnipresent Interpersonalities, Tiantai's Four Steps for Rereading Impermanence as the Eternity of All Subjective States, and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion and the Center for Humanities. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette and Tim Skog. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Leidhodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.